Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Collective Breath tent, and very nice to see you all. I'm just going to briefly introduce the project and then hand you over to all the speakers. My name's Jenny Warwin. I'm the curator of the World of Art programme. This is the fifth year that we've been working with WOMAD, but it's the first time that we've been able to commission a brand new work from an artist. So it's particularly nice to be working with Neville Gaby on this project, which is entitled Experiments in Black and White. And you will probably have found some of the screens and the performances that are going on in the Arboretum. If you haven't already seen them, I urge you to go there later today or tomorrow. The programme for the next 45 minutes is this. Neville will introduce the project for about 5 minutes. He's sitting next to me. Matt Rigby is sitting next to Neville, and he is a research fellow at the University of Bristol in the chemistry department, specialising in greenhouse gases. Next to Matt is Ellen O'Gorman, who's a classicist, but also performs, as you can probably see because of what she's holding on her lap. She performs in two Bristol music groups. And in the corner is Guy Blanche, who's a research engineer. He's developing technology in the waste business and biogases and working in agricultural context. Okay, so they've all been asked to speak for no longer than 8 minutes. And so I'm going to try and keep them to that. And because we're not doing any projections or PowerPoint projects, we've asked them all to bring something to demonstrate, illustrate their talk in some way. Okay, over to you then, Neville.
Do you want to stand? Stand. Hi, thanks very much for coming to our little tent. Where to start? I guess maybe I'll start in 2009. I went to Antarctica with the British Antarctic Survey. And I went to Halley Research Station, which is the most southerly. And I actually went for the idea of doing something ridiculously playful in a really extreme and distant environment. So my proposal was to go to Antarctica and fly kites, but actually, which was fantastic. But on my return, in some ways, things got more serious. I was invited by Bristol University to be artist in residence with the Cabot Institute. And the Cabot is really, it operates within the university, and the idea is to bring together researchers from across disciplines in the university and beyond who are working around issues of climate change. It was a fantastic experience, and really a lot of the work that you'll see here, experiments in black and white, came out of my time with Cabot. Today, actually, we've got three people who are very, very influential in terms of what we're doing in this tent. Cabot organized a series of sort of informal discussions, really, and one of them was around air. And everyone was invited just to bring something related to their work and air, and I kind of went to that. And that really influenced a lot of what we did. Matt is going to talk to you a little bit about the chemistry of it, but I became fascinated by air as a substance and what it carries. Eileen was there as well and talked about playing a musical instrument and the sound starting in the pit of your belly and rising as a column through your body into the tip of the instrument, which I just thought was absolutely kind of a beautiful sort of idea. So really the idea of collective breath was to see if I could get people to contribute the breath of their air, compress it into this air cylinder, and collectively for it to play a sound. Again, that's quite a technical process, and Guy, who's sitting at the end, is really responsible for helping me with a lot of the technical stuff, the tank, the pressure gauges, air flows. That are completely out of my depth without Guy, so thank you, Guy. I think really, for me, it's the other speakers who I'm really keen for you to hear from, but I thought what I might do is just read a tiny little bit from what I took to that discussion around air, and it's from a book by Primo Levi called The Periodic Table. He's a writer who died in 1980s. He's a fantastic writer, but he spent most of his life, well, all of his life, working as a chemist. And sometimes he just wrote very beautifully about stuff, materials, the things that I suppose I as a sculptor are really interested in. And there's one chapter which he wrote in this book about carbon, which, I mean, this book is, as you can tell, it goes back a long time, but it's always been something that I've held sort of close to me. And he talks about a carbon atom being really stable, doesn't change its form at all, but something that can move really through all sorts of... I feel paranoid talking in front of a chemist. but that is a stable, you know, particle that moves. So from air, can be absorbed into different things. So it's fluid. Let me read this. It's far more eloquent than me. But precisely for the good fortune of the narrator, whose story could otherwise have come to an end, the limestone rock ledge on which the atom forms a part lies on the surface. It lies within reach of man and his pickaxe. All honour to the pickaxe, its modern equivalents. They are still the most important intermediaries in the millennial dialogue between the elements and man. At any moment which either narrator decide out of pure caprice to be the year 1840, a blow from the pickaxe detached it, sent it on its way to the lime kiln, plunged it into a world of things that change. It was roasted until it separated from the calcium, which remained, so to speak, with its feet on the ground, and went to meet a less brilliant destiny, which we shall not narrate. Still firmly clinging to its two of its three former oxygen companions, it issued from the chimney and took the path of the air. Its story, which once was immobile, now turned tumultuous. It was caught by the wind, flung down on the earth, lifted 10 kilometers high. It was breathed in by a falcon, descended into its precipitous lungs, but did not penetrate its rich blood, and was expelled. It was dissolved three times in water of the sea, and once in the water of a cascading torrent, and again was expelled. It traveled with the wind for 8 years, now high, now low, on the sea and among the clouds, over forests, deserts, the limitless expanses of ice. Then it stumbled into capture and the organic adventure. And I think that's really, in a way, is a little bit about what I was trying to do with our collective breath. And I think maybe at that point, I'm going to pass you on to Matt.
Okay, thanks, Neville. So as I was introduced, I'm a researcher at the University of Bristol, and I'm really interested in trying to understand how the atmosphere's composition is changing. So I work in a group where we try and measure the gases in the atmosphere, and then we try and understand what's causing the concentrations in the atmosphere to change. So just to try and illustrate what I mean by the composition of the atmosphere, I've brought some beans with me. My wife is a vegetarian, so I find it hard to come up with analogies that aren't bean or pulse-based. But if we imagine that this jar of kidney beans here represents the kind of bulk air, the most common parts of air, so these would be nitrogen and oxygen molecules, which is what 99 point something or other percent of the atmosphere is really made of. But I'm really not interested in these. I kind of accept that oxygen is an important part of the atmosphere, but really, I don't really care about that too much. What I'm interested in, if there are about 2,500 kidney beans in there, I'm interested in molecules like this, this pinto bean here. For every one of these, there's 250,000, 2,500 molecules of ordinary air. And this pinto bean represents carbon dioxide. So this is, as everyone knows, a greenhouse gas, and it's also one of the main components of our breath when we breathe out. But the interesting thing about this gas is that it's really, life wouldn't be here without it. Despite it being in such a small concentration, it's really responsible for, you know, for us all being here in the first place. And the reason for that is that for our position in space, we'd be a very cold, icy rock or an ice-covered ball, really, floating in space if it wasn't for this. And the reason for this is this gas is just happens to be really good at trapping infrared radiation. That's the kind of the warmth that you feel coming off the ground on a warm day like today. So on a day like today, the sun's beaming through the atmosphere. It's basically, the atmosphere is transparent to the sun's rays, so the sun can heat the ground quite quickly. And then as the ground radiates its heat out towards space, these molecules of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere absorb some of that radiation and then they re-radiate it back towards us at the ground. And so this molecule has a really nice effect in that it keeps the surface of the Earth much warmer than it would be otherwise. So that's obviously a fantastically important and, you know, we wouldn't be here without it. But as, of course, everyone knows, we're changing the amount of these pinto beans in the atmosphere. We've increased by about 50% the concentration of pinto beans in the atmosphere. That sounds wrong. So obviously that brings with it an increased warming of the Earth's surface, and so things like, you know, the biosphere and things like that are going to change as a result. And so that's, I'm not going to get into all the details of what might happen under climate change, but of course I just want to show that we're now changing the composition of the Earth's atmosphere. And it's not just the pinto beans that are building up in the atmosphere. At Bristol, we measure a whole suite of gases that are also there. And actually, the smallest gases that we measure, which are also really potent greenhouse gases, we'd have to have, instead of one jar of kidney beans here to contain one of them, I worked out that we need 40,000 swimming pools worth of kidney beans to keep them. And so these are gases that come out of, you know, refrigeration units and air conditioners and things like that. And despite being in such tiny concentrations, they do have an appreciable warming effect on the Earth's surface. So the kind of, just to give you a flavour of the research we do, so we can measure these gases now in, you know, remarkably high precision. We can find these beans in a sea of kidney beans, and we can see how they vary from one day to the next. We can see how they're changing from one year to the next. And by looking at those variations in time and in space, what we try and do is use models of how the air moves to try and work backwards and work out what's being emitted from the Earth's surface. And so there are a few reasons for that. One is that we want to try and make sure that people are emitting what they claim to be emitting. So every country is supposed to report its greenhouse gas emissions every year. And we find that sometimes they get that right, sometimes they get that wrong. But we're also trying to use this information to learn about the biosphere. So by being able to figure out how much carbon dioxide, how much methane is being emitted from, you know, trees and plants and wetlands, we can start to learn something maybe about how the carbon cycle is going to respond to this change in the temperature of the Earth's surface. So I better stop talking, so I'll hand you over. But I hope that gives you a flavour of the kind of work we do and how it ties into breath and the composition of the atmosphere.
Okay. Sorry, I've got to use some notes. I'm normally in a workshop and I don't get out for public speaking, so sorry about that. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'll give you a quick introduction to both projects here. The Collective Breath, working with Neville, and the project that I'm working on, which is micro anaerobic digestion. My name's Guy Blanche. I'm a development engineer specialising in waste and biomass technology. So a friend in the village asked me to give Neville a call. He was working on this project, and perhaps I could give him a hand with compressing this gas from various people. Sounded like a bit of a mad project, so I thought I'd better have a look at it. Basically, we're taking the bags. We're going to empty them into the tank, and then Neville's going to make a sound with this lovely instrument. We'll be using vacuum pumps and a compressor to transfer the air in from the bags, and there's a safety feature. Sorry about that. There's also a safety feature on the tank just to make sure we don't blow the instrument apart, because there's a lot of pressure in there, but we're not using all that pressure at once. So moving on to micro anaerobic digestion. This also involves collecting breath, but it's not from humans, it's from bacteria, basically living in the waste. So over 10 years ago, I was working with Wiltshire Wildlife Trust, which is nearby here, on a food waste collection project where we were collecting food waste from schools, kitchens, canteens, and we're using composting, which is an aerobic process. But it doesn't make gas, and it also produces like a black leachate from all the food waste, which has a high water content. So it worked okay, but after that experience, I worked with Community Composting Network, which is CCN. They help sort of community projects get involved with composting in their local environments. So this was another food waste project, but this time it was an anaerobic process, which means it's without oxygen in a closed vessel. We call it a digester. And they come in all shapes and sizes. Most of you who live in a rural environment would know about farm gas systems. That's using cow or pig slurry and perhaps maize, which is slightly controversial. It's a kind of biochemical process which converts organic matter or biomass into gas or liquid fertilizer. And it's full of nutrients, NPK. So using the lessons that we learned from the CCN project, there was a core group of sort of fellow micro AD nutcases which helped set up this LEAP project. This is another food waste project. We're running three sites in Camden in London, different digester sizes, and we're trying to demonstrate different technologies. So we're utilising gas for cooking, we're using it for heating with a combined heat power, like a CHP. We'll be running biomethane vehicles shortly. We use it for refrigeration. And we're also, this is quite an interesting bit, we're recovering the carbon dioxide, which we're using for algae and growing trials. So there's a lot of scope there. And perhaps if you get a chance, you're ever in London, you'd like to come and have a look at that project. So having worked in various sectors and industries, I've kind of decided there's enough scope in micro-AD to keep me busy probably for the rest of my life. Apart from the engineering challenges, there's all the biochemical aspects, but I'm not really a biologist, so I stay on the fringes of that. I just need to understand the basics. But particularly the social challenges, the cultural issues, there's all the decontamination, all the plastics and all the foreign objects, forks and batteries that we put in our food waste. So that's quite challenging to get those out. So this project is also, I mean, this technology is particularly exciting because it can be linked in with sanitation projects, of which I've been lucky enough to be involved with in Madagascar. So they're converting existing pit latrines into using them with digesters, and then they're using the gas, the methane for cooking, or heating water, and for charging mobile phones, all sorts of opportunities. But also it's particularly good for resolving water contamination. Finally, getting to the end of this, how many minutes have I got left? So for all you youngsters out there which are not sure of a career path, I would strongly suggest engineering. It's exciting, it's rewarding, it's particularly challenging, and especially working with renewables energy. So have a think about your food waste that you're chucking away or your poo this weekend. Think about where it's going and what's going to happen to it, and perhaps you could change that. And then also for you oldies out there, perhaps you're looking for a new challenge in life. You might consider setting up a community AD system. So maybe you could become a food waste collection volunteer on a bike. Perhaps you could help with fundraising. Perhaps we could also persuade WOMAD to install a food waste digester next year. That would be good. I think the toilets might be a step too far next year. Thanks to Tammy and Jenny for letting me talk. Thanks for listening. If you're in London, we're just the project's near King's Cross behind sort of St Pancras Station. There's a little spot that's owned by London Wildlife Trust. So come and have a look. And I've got some leaflets if you want some more info. Thanks.
I'm going to start with a story about the, I think it's the earliest instance of collecting air in a bag. And you probably already know this story because it's part of the story of Odysseus, the wandering hero. And it's one of the things that I teach when I'm at the university. So early on in his travels, Odysseus reaches the island of Aeolus. And Aeolus has been charged by the gods with the responsibility of looking after the winds in the world. He entertains Odysseus as his guest. And when Odysseus is leaving, he gives him a gift. And it's a bag of air. Specifically, it's a bag of all the winds in the world, except one wind, the wind which will take Odysseus home. So he keeps that bag in his hold, and so long as it stays closed, he has a favouring wind to take him home. And they get very, very close to Ithaca, so close that they can see the people in the fields tending the sheep. And at that point, Odysseus gives in to weariness, and he hands over the helm to someone else, and he goes to sleep. But while he sleeps, his crew talk among themselves, and they conclude that the bag must hold gold and silver, which Odysseus is not going to share with them. So they sneak down to the hold. Of course, they open the bag, and all the winds rush out. There's a terrific storm, and they're driven far away from their home. And it's 10 more years before Odysseus gets home. When he goes home, he's destitute. He's a beggar. He has no ship. And all of his crew have died. He was unable to save them, even though he wanted to. So that's a very dark story. I partly tell it because it's so different from what Neville is doing here. It illustrates for me the difference between air and breath. Air seems to me to be entirely impersonal. The winds don't care whether they take Odysseus home or whether they drive him to shipwreck and ruin. But breath is what makes air personal. When we take the air into our lungs and then emit it in the way that Matt has described, we have an effect on the world, but that's also part of our being in the atmosphere and the atmosphere being in us. And I came to some of these conclusions partly through the myths that I study, but also partly through the musical instrument that I play. And right now I really wish that that instrument was bagpipes, because that would be another bag of air and that would just be too perfect. But unfortunately it's not, so I can't give you a bag, I can only give you a tube. That is my recorder. And I chose this recorder because it really illustrates how the recorder is just a tube. It's a very primitive way of making a sound into the atmosphere and then getting a sound back from someone else. Neville has already talked about the way I've talked about this before at the AIR seminar, the way in which recorder players get a little bit hung up on the pretty kinds of wood that their instruments are made out of. But really, it could be made out of plastic. It wouldn't make any difference. It has exactly the same effect, which is that it is an artificial extension of the column of air, which is your breath. And as Neville said, that starts in the pit of your stomach, it rises up through your breathing tube, and then it comes out through the tube that is the instrument. And so the tip of the instrument is the end of your air column, is actually this tip, not this tip. That's where your air comes out, where your breath comes out as sound. And the first sublime moment that you have as a wind player is the moment where you're playing the instrument and the instrument ceases to exist as a thing. You literally do not feel the wood or the plastic under your fingertips anymore. Instead, you are acutely aware that what you're playing is your own breath. That's all that's there. It's just you and your breath. And the feeling of the wood has simply disappeared from under your hands. So that's the first sublime moment of the recorder player, and that moment is connected to this idea of breathing atmosphere and being in the world. The second sublime moment is related to what else happens with breath and atmosphere, and that is, as I've already said, sound. We all know that in space no one can hear you scream. It's only in the atmosphere of the Earth that people can hear you speak or sing. And speech and song is the beginning of communication with others and therefore the beginning of community. So breath is fundamentally linked to community. So as a recorder player, I become aware of this when I play with other people. And that, as you can see from the leaflets, is what I do all the time. I'm not a soloist. I play with other people. When two recorder players play together, one produces one note, another produces another note, and from the interaction of those two notes, the differences between them, a third note appears. It's what's called a difference tone. Many of you will probably already know this. And it's created from the interaction of the vibrations of the first two sounds. And that sound literally comes out of the air. I am aware of the sound I'm making. I'm aware of the sound my friend is making. And then we both become aware of this third sound, which can only be produced from the interaction between our sounds. So the second sublime moment for the recorder player is when they play with a group of people, when they're acutely aware of other people's breathing, so aware that they know when their friends are going to breathe before their friends breathe, and they're acutely aware that the sounds they are making together are creating other sounds which are produced within the air itself. And that is the second sublime moment of recorder playing, and that is all about breath and community. And I'll end there. Thank you.
Thank you all very much indeed. That was a really good moment to introduce the project.